We live in a stressed culture. I used to be dismayed when our children from primary school on came home talking about the levels they'd received for their work and also talking about what they needed to do to get a better mark next time. Many children seem to suffer real anxiety about how their performance compares with others. Why are mental health issues sharply on the increase? One reason, I guess, would be that we are grading our children against standards from the very beginning of their lives. And all of this isn't primarily about the attainment of the child, it's really about the attainment of the school, with the first being used as a way to assess the second. The whole business of education for children, for parents, and for teachers seems to be so much more stressful than it was. And parents seem to be more harried, more competitive, and more anxious about whether they're doing it right than ever before. Parenting used to be something we learned from our parents. Now we tend to live too far away, and we have to learn something we have to learn from books. Trouble is, the books don't all say the same thing. They have different strategies for feeding, weaning, discipline, swaddling. The list is endless. So we're not sure that we're doing it right. We live in a stressed culture. We see that in weddings as well. No one used to talk about wedmen. People just used to have the traditional voluntaries, Wagner on the way in, Mendelssohn on the way out. I can't remember the last time that happened. People often say to me now, well, I really like that piece of music, but so-and-so had it at her wedding, so we've got to have something else. Where people were once buying into an institution they received, now everyone feels the need to remake it in their own image. Everything has to be different from any other wedding they've attended. It has to be individualized to the nth degree, from the proposal. So much more stressful, the proposal these days. You've got to hire a choir just amazing. You get them all onto the same carriage on the underground at the same time. From the proposal to the invite, mind you, that's the last time the groom, frankly, is stressed about the wedding, but that's another. From the proposal to the invitations, to the table centres, to the first dance. And with each decision, the stress seems to rise. My personal best as a minister for bridesmaids is now nine adult bridesmaids. My personal best for people at the rehearsal, all with an opinion, a different opinion about the wedding, how the wedding should go. My personal best for people at the rehearsal is at least 25 people. And there are now so many more bits to a wedding. You have to check the invitation. Am I invited to this bit or not? And they're gruesomely expensive. A quick web search reveals that the average cost for last year was somewhere between £27,000 and £30,000. £38,000 if you live in London. My children are not here. I can say we've left it rather late to start saving. Weddings seem to have become much more stressful. Planning a wedding is now a demanding part-time job for the best part of 18 months to 2 years. We live in a really stressed culture. We see that in the way our technology has invaded us. I wonder when was the last time you switched your mobile phone off? How many alerts have you had on your mobile phone today? You know the little pings that tell you an email or an update or a text has just arrived and is demanding your attention right now. Not this afternoon, not in half an hour's time or even 30 seconds, but right now. I hate the way that a text message arrives and if you haven't looked at it within a couple of minutes, it pings again. I remember sitting in a coffee shop recently watching a young couple. They drew my attention because they hardly said a single word to one another. All the time they were there, in a relationship seemingly, they were glued to their phones. They didn't look at one another. Their thumbs were going. Maybe they were both looking at dating sites, I don't know, because there's clearly nothing going on between them at all. Our devices have invaded our lives, our heads, and even our hearts. And the problem with all of this is that it becomes so difficult to draw boundaries. Boundaries between work and home. Boundaries between work and leisure. Boundaries between family time and social time. They all just blend into one, and the cost is we never switch off. We are never really at rest. We have a friend, Ben, who is incredibly devoted to his technology. The number of times we've sat at tables with him and he's been on his phone, he's not really there with us. If your work email can ping through to your mobile at any time of day or night, you are never really off duty. Work is always with you. And that means that switching off becomes formidably difficult. And hardly ever is it something that cannot wait. But we buy into the always-on culture. Maybe it makes us feel important. Maybe because we're feeling anxious about how we're seen at work. And the consequence is we never step fully away from work until we have one of those binge resting periods that we used to call holidays. Even our exercise seems to have become bizarrely stressful effort to go further and faster, as though we were preparing to enter the SAS in a war that never comes. We live in such a stressed culture. And from those levels of constant stress comes anxiety and profound unhappiness. It so very often doesn't look like the easy yoke Jesus promises us. So very often doesn't look like life in all its fullness. Some of that stress comes from the news and wider political uncertainty. But there's nothing we can do about that other than pray. Please pray for Donald Trump, who is giving a lecture about Islam in the Middle East today. I'm not worried about that at all. There's no more, though, than the backdrop against which we live our lives. So I want to focus this morning on those things that are within our grasp, those things about which we can have direct influence. And I want to ask how we can find life in all its fullness within such a stressed culture. First challenge Jesus gives us is not to be anxious. Our passage begins, "Therefore I tell you," that refers back to the previous passage where we're challenged to choose between God and money, to choose between them because we can't serve both, to choose between them and to make sure our treasure is in heaven. And on that basis, Jesus then tells us not to be anxious. Verse 25, "Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life or about your body. Is not life more important than food, the body more important than clothes?" A better translation would be, I think, "Do not be anxious." It could even be translated, "Do not be unduly anxious." Because there's a difference, isn't there, between a justified concern and living in a state of pervasive anxiety from which we never surface. When my father recently had a stroke, it was quite reasonable for me to be really concerned. His life was in genuine danger for a time. Jesus isn't saying, don't be concerned about something like that. But he is saying, I think, don't be in a place of consuming anxiety about it. Pray about it. Pray about it whenever it comes to your attention, but don't be consumed by it. There's a difference between a justified concern and living in a state of anxiety. Quite some years ago now, I had a brief time off work when I was worn out and anxious, and I realized I was stressed and anxious when the situation wasn't. That I was much more stressed than the situation required. I've been in lots of other situations in ministry when I've been stressed because the situation was stressful. But on that occasion, it wasn't the case. I think that's the difference between a justified concern and living in a state of perpetual anxiety. When we've got a justified concern, we need to bring it positively to the Lord and leave it in his hands. Keep giving it to him as often as it comes up. Peter writes, "Cast all your anxieties on him because he cares for you." 1 Peter 5:7. when we're living in a state of anxiety, then we need to rise to Jesus' challenge and to seek to live differently. That's the second challenge Jesus gives, to trust our Heavenly Father. He gives us two simple comparisons. Verse 26, he tells us to look at the birds of the air. They don't weary themselves in farming, yet we see around us that our Heavenly Father feeds them. If, Jesus asks, that's how the Father looks after them, how much more will he care for those made in his image? That's the first simple comparison. That's how the Father looks after the birds. How can we doubt that he'll look after us, who, in the words of Psalm 8, have been made a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned with glory and honour? And that first simple comparison ends with a punchline. It's literally verse 27. Which of you, by being anxious, can add a single cubit to his height? Cubit's about 6 inches. Jesus is just saying, worrying about being short isn't going to make you taller. If it would, I'd be 8'6" by now. Walking around as though the weight of the world is on our shoulders will not make us, it will actually make us shorter. The point Jesus is making is clear. That kind of worry is fruitless. It's pointless. It won't get us an inch closer to the goal. You just can't worry yourself into being 6 inches taller. The conclusion is as clear as the point. We have to choose to trust the Heavenly Father who provides so abundantly for the birds of the air. Second simple comparison concerns the flowers of the field. The word lily wasn't used with any botanical precision then. So flowers of the field is a better translation. Picture a moment, a traditional English meadow, strewn with flowers of a profusion of colours. Just picture that in your mind. Consider, Jesus is saying, the flowers of the field, the meadow. Isn't there glorious colour beyond even the richest robes of Solomon? And they do nothing. Nothing other than grow and open their petals in the sun. If God will kiss simple flowers with such beauty, even though they're here today and gone tomorrow, Jesus says, surely we can trust him to help us flourish in turn when we are made in his image and loved by him. The emphasis in both comparisons is the same. If God provides for the birds of the air, surely we can choose to trust him to provide for us. If God provides gloriously for the flowers of the field, surely we can choose to trust him not just to provide for us, but to provide for us in ways that make us flourish. As Jesus says in verse 32, all the nations run after these things, and our Heavenly Father knows that we need them. We have to choose to trust our Heavenly Father both to provide and to enable us to flourish, to deal with our anxiety. Trust God to provide and to flourish. And third, we need to seek God's kingdom first. Verses 32 and 33. The nations run after all these things. Your Heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these other things will be given to you as well. Jesus is saying, trust my Father to look after you as he looks after the birds of the air and the flowers of the field. Trust my Father to look after you and make your first priority his kingdom and his righteousness. That's the way, he's saying, to get all of your other needs met. What does that mean? But seeking God's righteousness as our priority has got to mean living as authentic disciples, as people who don't just talk the talk but walk the walk. In context of Matthew 6, that certainly means choosing God over mammon and seeking our treasure in him alone. But it also means choosing service over selfishness, the needs of others over our own. It means choosing the way of love and humility over the way of power and pride. It means choosing grace always, even when it hurts, even when it cuts against us to do so, even when it goes against every natural inclination, choosing grace. Our first priority, Jesus says, has got to be living as God desires. That's the way to ensure that everything we're worried about is added to us as well. And seeking God's kingdom as a priority has got to mean honoring his lordship above all things. It's about honoring God and pursuing his purpose in the world. Whether it's finding a way to serve in church through the volunteer, whether it's getting involved in community mission through street passes or Safe Families, through Basics Bank, Communicare or Taste Life, whether it's getting involved in wider mission through the Ports of Prayer team or Holiday Club, Treasure Hunting or Alpha. There are lots and lots of ways in which you can get involved in pursuing God's kingdom in and through this church. But it's not just about doing stuff for God. It's also about honoring him as king in our choices and in how we choose to live and work with others. It's about putting his glory above all things. It's about choosing to witness when the opportunity's there, doing what God's done for, sharing what God's done for you or means to you. It might mean promising to pray for a colleague or a friend, and of course, it means following through on that promise. It might mean being prepared to post on social media photos taken at church events, as well as in photos from classier or cooler places you go to. When we make God's kingdom and God's righteousness that which we pursue first above all else, what happens is it pulls everything else into the right shape. Not only do we live trustfully, not only do we receive what we need from the Father, but we also see his name being honored and his kingdom being fruitful in and around us. Remember that our passage follows on from one about choosing between God and money, about laying up treasures in heaven. That's what we're doing when we allow God's priorities to become our own. Jesus' word to us is that we need to deal with our anxiety, to trust our Heavenly Father to provide and to help us flourish. And it means to seek God's kingdom first and alone. But how do we do that in a really stressed culture? The first response is to prune our priorities. To prune our priorities. Do you remember Mary Poppins' bag? Remember when she pulls a huge standard lamp out of her bag that's standing on a table, it goes on and on, and the children are looking under the table to see where the lamp came from. Well, I'm sorry, we are not Mary Poppins. You and your diary, your mind and your heart are not a bag with an infinite capacity. There's a limit to what you can stuff into it before it comes apart at the seams. So sit down on your own. Try and work through the list of what you were attempting to do every week and ask God what needs to go. What doesn't actually need to be done? And what are you not doing that would actually help you flourish because you just don't have time? What needs to go to make time? Which of your children's 17 activities this week could go without ruining their chance of getting into the right university in 15 years' time? And where's the essential being pushed out by the merely urgent? Where's what you're really committed to just being pushed out by the simply stroppy or demanding? That's a tough one I struggle, the essential and the urgent, with pretty much every week. Ask yourself honestly, to what extent is my life showing that I'm seeking God's kingdom first and alone? The second response is to take a Sabbath rest. I've been very challenged recently that taking a Sabbath was a command, not a suggestion. And that when I find myself unable to take one, I'm not being diligent, I'm being disobedient. God rested. The Bible tells us after all the labor of creation, God rested and made the Sabbath day holy. We remember that God respected the Sabbath between Good Friday and Easter Day. We remember that every living thing that God has made seems to have been created to require rest, whether it's a daily sleep or a seasonal rest in winter, every living thing seems to have been created to require rest. There are rhythms, there are seasons for every living thing. If God himself rested, if the creation reflects that need for rest, why do we think we can do without it? I wonder if one of the untold stories of the loss of the day of rest 30, 35 years ago is that it has led inexorably to our incredibly stressed culture and rising levels of anxiety now. Sarah, my wife, and I have been trying to see in the Sabbath an invitation to rest. We're ceasing not just our work, we're also ceasing our family admin, our shopping, our work, our family work as well. Trying to prioritize rest and recreation and taking a holiday every week. A holiday every week is what the Sabbath is supposed to be. And to keep the boundary between work and rest more carefully. I now physically change the SIM in my phone when I'm not at work. I switch email off as I go to bed the night before my Sabbath. Yes, a few key people have got my number and a private email address so I can be reached if absolutely necessary, but almost always anything that comes when you're resting can wait. Almost always it can wait. Trouble is, you get an email about a situation you're stressed about, and it pulls you straight back into work, straight back into worrying and focusing on that difficult situation. So don't let it. Keep that boundary more carefully and step aside from work for a whole day. It's not always easy to make it work. Sometimes requires working harder, ironically, to create the space. And yet the day itself is a delight when we get there. And that changing rhythm holds real promise for us. We're trying not to be too legalistic about it. Yes, if we're at a National Trust property recreating, we will have a cup of coffee in the coffee shop. We just won't do our grocery shop that day. But the principle is really crucial in our always-on, never-stop culture. Having a day's holiday every week to rest and to recreate. In the anxious, stressed culture around us, we have to learn to stop more. Even the smartphone, that symbol of the digital always-on culture, speaks to the importance of rest. It cannot run forever. I know many of you out there will have a second battery pack for your phone so it can run forever, but it cannot run forever. It has to be plugged in to recharge. And they actually recharge much faster when they're switched off. And when we stop, we're saying that we trust God to be God and to look after everything while we invest in rest, in reflection and recreation. How could the Sabbath principle work in your life? Put it in first as a priority, and then it will be a gift, an oasis around which all else revolves. And the third response is to find again a rhythm of prayer. Nothing is more significant to me as a Christian than prayer. That's where I get nourished. That's where I find stillness, grace, and perspective. And if it doesn't happen, nearly always through sheer busyness, I always feel the lack. Search for a rhythm of prayer that suits you. Finding that rhythm, finding that repose in God is life-changing and life-giving. If you take nothing else away from this sermon, take that. Use the booklet of reflections from staff members that's at the back. There are going to be testimonies on prayer from other church members over coming weeks. Come to the workshops on different styles of prayer over the next couple of months and seek God in prayer. Seek from God a rhythm of prayer that will suit you and enable you to flourish like the flowers of the field. There isn't a single way to pray. Find the way to pray that will suit and grow you in your faith. Everything flows from there. Let God enfold you in his grace. Let God cause streams of living water to flow with you, with flow within you again. Let God fill you with his love and with his spirit for the first time, for the thousandth time. All these things flow from encountering God in prayer. Jesus challenges us to lay down our anxieties, to trust our Heavenly Father to provide and help us flourish, and to seek God's kingdom first and alone. In the midst of our stressed and anxious culture, finding life in all its fullness means pruning our priorities because we are not Mary Poppins. It means taking a Sabbath rest as a holiday every week. It means finding our rhythm of prayer so that we can encounter God day by day and be transformed. And frankly, that's what those around us in this incredibly stressed culture need to see in us. They need to see life in all its fullness. So don't think this is just an inward priority. It's also a priority for mission. So what is the challenge? Even better, what is the invitation to you? And how are you going to respond?